Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the Pulitzer Prize winning author of All the Light We Cannot See, Anthony Doerr, whose latest novel is drawing comparison to the former for the way it braids a series of storylines into a satisfying whole. Cloud Cuckoo Land is a term from Greek drama often used in British literature and letters and is the name of Doerr's book. And it also is a text he has created, which he attributes to Diogenes, the cynic who carried a lantern in search of an honest man. That text helps weave together storylines set on the eve of the Byzantine Empire's fall in the 15th century, where we meet Anna, an orphan seamstress apprentice who yearns to learn and ends up smuggling books from the city's libraries out of the city, just as Constantinople prepares for the Ottoman takeover and sack. On that same line, we meet a Slavic peasant, Omer, who, along with his beloved oxen, have been drafted into the invading army. In the present, we meet Zeno, a self-taught classical scholar whose slight knowledge of the Odyssey saved him as a prisoner of war in Korea. Now, in old age, he's teaching Cloud Cuckoo Land to young children at the library. Also on this timeline, a disaffected youth, Seymour, who relates to the animal world far better than the world of humans. He takes action when his neighboring forest is destroyed for tract housing. And finally, Constance, aboard the starship Argo, on the way to a faraway planet with an Earth-like atmosphere, a journey she will never reach. Only her descendants will. Constance is told to look forward, but she is fascinated by looking back at Earth through the vast virtual reality library Sybil. Doerr weaves these storylines seamlessly with metaphors of walls, books, and nature. Anthony Doerr is the author of a memoir, two short story collections, and Cloud Cuckoo Land is his third novel. Anthony Doerr, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me today, Rich.
You know, I've heard this term that you use for the title of your book, Cloud Cuckoo Land. I usually hear it in political discussions over the years, and I always felt like it was the perfect description for an utterly wacky idea. But I never knew where it came from until I read this book. It seems a pretty apt description for the last few years. How did you first come across it, and how did you decide to name this book Cloud Cuckoo Land?
Oh, I'm so glad you have heard it. So few Americans seem to have. It seems much more common in British and Irish English, so I'm glad it's at least vaguely familiar to you. I also had not heard the term before. My book is kind of about the fragility of books in general, and I started in by reading about the Greek tragedy writers, you know, Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, and how few of their plays are left. You know, Aeschylus wrote 90 plays and only 7 survived. Sophocles wrote around 100 plays, we think, only 7 survived. And then there's Aristophanes. And, you know, nobody really even knows how many plays, you know, mostly comedies he was writing to be performed in ancient Greece. This is about 2,400 years ago, but we only have about 7. And some people think he wrote as many as 110. And that alone is so interesting to me that, you know, when you're growing up, you think all the ancient books that we have were all the ancient books ever written. And it's such a reminder that we're just looking at this tiny corner, really, of this big tablecloth or this big portrait landscape and making assumptions about it just from the few books that have survived all those centuries. But yeah, he had maybe the original buddy comedy. It was called The Birds, and these two kind of fools that you're meant to kind of laugh at decide there are too many lawyers, basically, in Athens, and they decide to found a new city in the sky, halfway between the realm of humans on the earth and the realm of the gods in the heavens. And with the help of the birds, they build the utopia called Cloud Cuckoo Land. Of course, like all utopia narratives, you know, once you get there, it's not quite as utopian as you hoped. And of course, some things start decaying around them. But the phrase really stuck with me. And in both that disparaging way that you're saying, you know, somebody who thinks COVID will go away tomorrow might be living in Cloud Cuckoo Land. That's certainly how a British person might use the phrase, in a disparaging way. But there's also this beautiful sense of humans, all these different human cultures through the centuries have dreamed of better places far away. And so that idea of a city in the clouds or a castle in the clouds really has always compelled me. You know, maybe this is my middle-aged book. You know, growing up, I'm always thinking the grass is greener somewhere else. And getting older has helped me kind of accept, like, this is as good as it's going to get. I'm as young as I'm ever going to be. So I'm in some ways getting rid of my Cloud Cuckoo Lands. And in another sense, trying to make now, this time I have with my kids still at home and you know, with the environment as intact as I can, try to help make it. This is our Cloud Cuckoo Land right now, maybe, that we're living into.
Yeah, there is a strong environmental element that shows up in all of these disparate stories that you weave together. I hadn't thought about the fragility of books, but once you said that, yes, obviously this is a central theme of the book, whether it is back in Constantinople and the fall of the Byzantine Empire, which is one of the storylines. And, you know, of course, when the Ottomans came in, they sacked the city, they destroyed all the Christian relics, and they probably destroyed a lot of manuscripts at the same time. Another storyline is this futurist story of Earthlings seeking a new home in space. There are no more books. There are images of books. So this is a very timely theme that connects a lot of these stories.
Thanks, Rich. Yeah, good job summarizing a few of the storylines. The way I've been trying to think through it now in my 40s is my interest in the fragility of memory really came from when my grandmother moved in with us, my mom's mom. Moves in with us. I think I was 14 years old. My older brothers were already off in college. And mom sits me down and says, Grandma has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And this is in the mid-80s. I'd never heard the phrase before. Didn't really know what it meant. And then over the next 2 years, really watched my grandmother's self be eaten by this disease. And of course, it's too self-centered and too young to really comprehend what my mom and my father were going through. But I know that later in my life, I've just been so preoccupied. A lot of my projects somehow address time and how erasure is always stalking us in some way. And that, you know, of course, really erasure is coming for all of us, but especially in folks with dementia, it's just so painful to watch it happen. And there's something tied with that, with the erasure of manuscripts over time. So when my boys were first born, they were, this was 2004, we got this chance to move to Rome and live at the American Academy in Rome for a year and work on a book project. And around me in all these other offices were classicists. And it's just so interesting to see how many of them were working with limited resources. They worked with fragmentary texts. Some of them would even study lost texts and just try to read summaries or, you know, epitomes, they're called, of these lost texts. And you realize, like, that for any manuscript to make it to the present, it's gone on this epic journey. It's like a superhero's journey through floods and fires and tyrants and religious zealots and monks who just need the manuscript's paper, you know, the parchment, and they just scrape it free to use to teach other monks how to write or to write prayers. So, you know, for those books to survive all the way to the 15th century when the printing press arrives in Europe, really was based primarily in Constantinople. About 75%, especially of the ancient Greek texts we have, were transmitted to us through Constantinople because of these amazing defensive walls around the city and this series of libraries, imperial and monastic, and even private libraries inside the city. The walls around the city withstood 23 sieges, and they stood for 1,100 years. And I knew nothing about them. When I first got to Rome and people are talking about the walls of Constantinople, I'm like, what are you even talking about? It felt like in my American high school, we leapt from the fall of Rome to the Renaissance in about 6 seconds.
You're right.
And skipped 1,000 years in there. So I often use projects as a way to kind of chase my own curiosities. And so this seemed like a great opportunity. Once I finished my previous novel, All the Light We Cannot See, in about 2014, I thought, Constantinople, there's something there, something about this transmission of manuscripts through the centuries that really tells a story of stewardship. And I thought that could be kind of a poignant way to suggest just how blessed and lucky and fortunate we are to have any of these stories to last from people who lived on the earth 2,400 or 2,000 years ago.
You know, given that this novel combines what I would say is an ersatz story by Diogenes, a real person, but the story is created by you, and you have ancient Greek writing, Greek passages in the book, translated, thankfully, for the rest of us. And the story right. The story of Constantinople, I thought you must be a classicist, but this is something you said, I want to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I tend to, the common advice writers are given is write what you know about. And fundamentally, that's really good advice. You're fundamentally writing about heartbreak or falling in love or feeling alone or feeling different. And those kinds of feelings, are with you. And that's what it is to be a human. And that is what you know. But on the detail level, on the surface level, on the settings and the places, I tend to be drawn to things I want to know that I don't know when I begin a project. And I think going on that journey of discovery with a reader sometimes I can pour my enthusiasm into learning about these subjects into the text. And I think then I don't take things for granted. I'm learning maybe alongside the reader in a sense. So I didn't know any ancient Greek before I started this. All I had read was the Odyssey and Oedipus Rex in high school. That's right. All I really had in terms of a classical education. So diving back into this, trying to understand, you know, a little bit of Latin, a little bit of ancient Greek, and really just try to understand the power of all these myths that have traveled to us through Western civilization through the centuries. And yeah, so there's this, he was called a novelist, considered a novelist, Antoninus Diogenes. He lived in maybe the first or the second century CE, and 1900 years ago, wrote a novel called The Wonders Beyond Thule, T-H-U-L-E. Nobody really knows it. There's very, very little of it left. There's about four fragmentary pieces of it, just with a few broken sentences left. But we have a 9th century summary of it, and it sounded like this really innovative book that mushed together all these genres. It was like a mix of myths and traveler's tales. There may have even been the first Western story of a trip to outer space in which the characters go to the moon. Maybe the first science fiction story ever written down anyway. Of course, the novel's lost. So I thought it'd be fun to try to invent a manuscript that Diogenes could have written. I thread it through the novel, just pieces of it, and then tell the story through the five characters, the main characters of my novel called Club Cuckoo Land, of how this story touched and entered their lives and kind of fell into their laps when they needed it most.
Yeah, and like that summary, I think you've tried to do the same thing with your characters. And it's interesting that while Constantinople might have been the starting point for this exercise, if you will, that ended up in the novel, the first character we meet is, again, getting back to that space travel, it's a character, Constance, aboard the Argo, bound for an Earth-like planet, 4.5 light years from Earth. Everything, it's a very controlled environment. There's no Alexa, there's no Siri, but there's Sybil, who controls everything. They're headed towards a planet called Beta 02, and they're learning about this planet, although, as we learn through the novel, none of them will ever make it there. This is a 600-year journey. They're only less than 100 years into it, so everybody aboard will not make it. Give us a sense of where this particular thread line came from, and how did you come upon Constance as this way to tell the story?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the story, the novel is divided into five parts, or five main protagonists, and two are in the past in Constantinople in the 15th century. Two are living now, Vino and Seymour, living in the 21st century, and then there's Constance in the future. And there's so much interesting stuff as I started to contemplate. I wanted to show this text survive through the centuries. And so pretty early on, maybe a year into the project, I decided I need to show this land in the future. I need to show this land in a reader's hands who need it most, who needs this story to kind of survive her situation. So I started to read all these theories about when, if ever, humans might be able to leave the solar system. And of course, physics may make it totally impossible. They would need to travel at an enormously quick speed that we probably will never figure out. There are theories that maybe we'll be able to make these little tiny lightweight spacecraft that could go maybe print new life, settle different planets, exoplanets, and print new life on them. But just reading about exoplanets is so interesting. You know, growing up until the 80s, we didn't believe there were any other worlds like That's ours. Right. And now it seems like almost every day we're finding new mathematical tools to identify these planets. And it seems as if maybe every star, like our sun, is teeming with worlds around it. And so the quantity of exoplanets probably is enormous. It's so interesting to me that our world may be one of trillions. And so I just imagined that the stuff I was reading was suggesting that it would take a bridge generation or 5 or 10 of human beings that would live only aboard these spacecraft to try to get them to a new world. So I'm playing all the time with Cloud Cuckoo Lands and this idea of better places in the distance that you have to travel far to. And I'm also asking questions throughout the novel about stewardship. What does it mean to be a steward of human culture in terms of books? And what does it mean to be a steward of the planet in terms of the environment? And so in a sense, we're all bridge generations, and Constance is part of that. So I wanted to just ask questions as I watch my children get older, as I feel less and less important in my own life, which is really a good thing. I think thinking in particular is a really effective way to decenter yourself from your life. And in many ways, we're all just a bridge generation to the next generation. So Constance was a way for me to ask questions about that.
My guest today is Anthony Doerr, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist for All the Light We Cannot See, back in 2014. His new novel is titled Cloud Cuckoo Land. It's published by Scribner's. It's really a delightful read, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned the storyline in the present, and that idea of stewardship of books and our environment are sort of alive in the two characters. Zeno is an elderly man with a great attraction to this story. He was told it early in his life. It helped him through captivity in the Korean War. And as we meet him today, he's made a children's play of the story for the Lakeport Public Library up in Idaho. And he's teaching the kids the play. They're going to be doing this play. And in walks Seymour, who is also another character, a disaffected young man aiming for revenge. And both of these characters are all about stewardship. Zeno is a steward of the story, steward of books and learning. Seymour is a steward of in his own way, of the environment, perhaps to an extreme. But what starts out as a character that we don't really take an attachment to, we soon do find an attachment to in his backstory as we learn more about Seymour. Tell us about these two characters.
Oh, glad you began to feel attachment to Seymour. That's good. I'm doing my job well. I'm grateful, Rich. Zeno is a lover of language. He is taking him most of his life. He's an octogenarian when you first meet him, and it's taking most of his life to own his identity as a homosexual man. He's living in a small town in Idaho, and he has this experience during the Korean War. I hope this doesn't give too much away, that in which he is with a British man who knows ancient Greek, and really the way he survives this horrific ordeal of being a prisoner of war is to dive into stories and learning, and the little bit that this British man has memorized of the Odyssey and studying ancient Greek by just scratching it into the dust. And in many ways, it's a way of kind of slipping the trap. And so I try to use that idea of how stories help us slip the trap. And what I mean by that is just the trap of our own skulls. You know, I believe stories are perhaps the most effective vehicle we have to leave the confines of our own mind and enter the minds of others. And I think I like to think that that helps increase our senses of empathy and compassion. And so Zeno is a really sensitive, kind man. And as this story, this old ancient story called Cloud Cuckoo Land, enters his life as an older man, he collaborates with these five fifth graders in the Lakeport Public Library to put on a little rural library play. And they're doing a dress rehearsal of it, and in walks Seymour. Seymour grows up in the same town, and he is a steward in a way. I think he's a representative of kind of all of the grief and anger I feel occasionally when I read scientific papers about climate change or the biodiversity crisis and the way so many wild animals have been stripped out of the earth in the past 40 or 50 years. And although I would hopefully never behave in the way Seymour does, I try to make his decision that violence is the only option. I try to make that empathetic, although I absolutely understand if a reader's not willing to totally commit to that idea. But I just wanted to address what young people feel and how much guilt they want older generations like mine to feel for what we've been doing. In many ways, we've been living in a cloud cuckoo land of our own, burning petroleum and turning on our air conditioning and flying around the world and kind of presuming there won't be consequences for the next generations from our behavior. So I'm just trying to ask questions about that and not make any judgments on anybody, of course, but to try to suggest and think about what do the young generations feel about the state of the planet that they're inheriting.
Yeah, I don't think it's a secret to say that Seymour enters this book as an eco-terrorist. He's going to commit an act of terrorism. And only when we begin...
The intention of doing so.
Yes, he has the intention. And then as we hear about his story and we read more about him, we find out that this is a young man that has very tenuous connections to virtually any human in his life, his mother perhaps the most, but even that is a pretty tenuous connection. What has given him, what connections he has been to the natural world outside of his backyard. He is sort of bonded with the nature, and as development comes, that nature moves away and is basically plowed under due to development, and that is the source of his anger and upset. And it's a poignant story in and of itself, I think.
Thanks. I'm glad. I mean, I think so many rural communities and urban communities hear 7, I'm sure around Tulsa as well, are dealing with growth. And growth means natural habitats are giving way to housing developments. And me, and, you know, I'm not judging anybody for here to Boise. It's now, I think, the fastest growing metro area in the United States. And everybody is welcome, of course. But at the same time, running trails that I used to run on and couldn't see a house 3 or 4 years ago now are covered with houses. And, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean for young people who grew up identifying with the landscapes around them and now they find housing development in the way?
I want to talk about the Constantinople story. For Anna is a 13-year-old orphan living in Constantinople, lives among women who embroider robes for priests, but she has a thirst for learning. And I was struck by something you said. You know, Zeno scrapes out Greek symbols in the dirt. That's how Anna first learns to read, is the same way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And as she goes along, it turns out it looks like she is thieving to basically survive. But in another way, she's providing the fragments that survive now to today.
You got it. Perfect, Rich. You've got it. Hooray. Yeah, Anna, you know, she feels exactly how I would feel working in an embroidery house in the 15th century. You know, women primarily are expected to do these incredibly complicated jobs. They're making exquisite works of art often, but they're hunched over a table, and over the decades, your eyes start to fail, your back's hunched. Like, these are tiny knots, like grains of rice, tying them to primarily robes, vestments for priests to wear. You know, they're working 6 days a week. They're supposed to work from the moment you can, you know, see at your table until dark. And so she chafes against that as a young person. And she's living in a time, there were times in the Byzantine Empire where women were allowed to become literate, but she's living a time towards the end, the empire's fading, and girls just aren't encouraged to learn to become literate. And she longs to see outside the walls of the city. For so many generations of humans, you had no accurate picture of the earth. You know, we didn't know much beyond the walls of the villages and the towns and the cities that we lived in, except through story. And so in some ways, geography was indivisible from myth. And I'm playing a lot around with Cloud Cuckoo Land ideas a lot through that. Like, a story is what can deliver her a sense of travel and a sense of what lands, what magical or mundane lands might lie beyond the walls of Constantinople. So, and also just trying to remember what it was like to learn to read and what those feelings are when you first find books and that can deliver you to other places. So the first text she gets to confront is the Odyssey, and then later she starts kind of surreptitiously breaking into old libraries and discovering other books.
Yeah. You know, and just as Anna's wanting to break free of the walls that Constantinople have put up, Constant is doing the same aboard the Argo in this future environment where all of her, I guess, shipmates are looking forward to the future. Everyone's looking forward to when they arrive to Beta Oaf, even though they're told they'll never arrive. They're already telling stories about this planet they're headed to. Constant is moving back to the past. She uses the one book that the librarian says nobody ever wants to look at, the Atlas of where we've left. And she's doing the same thing. She's breaking through those walls.
That's great, Rich. You're all over it. Yeah, I'm playing a lot with concentric circles and the idea of sieges within sieges. So these children in the Lakeport Public Library opens, they're stuck inside the library, in a sense, under siege from Seymour. I've got the whole of Constantinople ringed by these walls and the Ottoman army in 1453. And so Anna is stuck in there with this book in her lap. She's under siege. And so the kids are going through this Cloud Cuckoo Land story, and they're trapped. Anna's going through it. She's trapped. And then there's Constance. And she, for reasons I probably shouldn't give away, she is trapped inside this circular room in the middle of this ship. And all she has for the moment is this atlas and access to this virtual library through this AI called Sybil. And so in some ways, she is also trapped. And she's going, you know, the atlas is a book within a book. And there's so many books within books inside of this book. And so I'm playing all the time with, you know, worlds inside worlds. And all that just ties back to the way I felt as a kid when my mom was a science teacher, and she used the local public library really as a kind of de facto daycare center for me and my brothers, and would drop us off. And I just found this place to be this holy land. Like, you know, a library is just full of portals to other worlds. And For me, a book is this universe that you can hold in your lap, this little self-contained world that can help you slip the trap of your day, whether it's just waiting for a doctor's appointment or stuck on a long flight or just in bed before you go to sleep. It's a way to slip out of your own, the confines of your own life and enter other lives. So I just am trying to almost write a hymn or a tribute to books and how they possess little universes inside them.
This is a novel that took a good amount of time, you know, I think 6 years or so. How did things change over the course of this novel as far as, I know you had to do a lot of threading together to get this book to a whole, but, you know, a lot of things have happened over that 6 year time in our present life. Was there anything that changed things along the way?
Absolutely. Yeah. Very astute question. So I finished All the Light We Cannot See in 2014, and already I have a drawing of the walls of Constantinople taped to the wall of my office. This is a reminder that this could be a project that I chase next, but really it's 7 years of fiddling and dreaming and grinding and revising and editing before this book is coming out. And so, of course, so much changes. When I start really researching hard and studying the Theodosian walls of Constantinople in the United States, all around us, we have a presidential candidate leading crowds in chants of build that wall. And, you know, it's so interesting to me, the psychological meaning of walls. And you start reading about the history of them and these really interesting new intellectual ideas that maybe walls, you know, rose up around the same time as private property, and maybe they helped build the sense of a patriarchy and inheritance. And you know, it's really the time we abandon a foraging lifestyle that walls start arriving. And around that time, you know, anthropologists think that's when violence also starts arriving and war. So those things are so interesting to me, and start reading about that. And then I read this book by David Quammen called Spillover. I want to say that was maybe in 2016, about how the possibility of the more human development encroaches on the natural world, the more possibility of things like the avian flu, where viruses spill over from animal populations into human populations. And of course, we're not totally scientifically sure right now on the cause of COVID, but a lot of theories suggest that maybe it's because of, you know, wild animal getting eaten by a human or a wild animal in a market in China. So who knows, but it certainly is very possible that the link of human expansion across the globe has resulted in COVID-19. And so, you know, I've got a pandemic in this novel, working on words like quarantine one and quarantine two,
yes,
as early as maybe 2017, 2018. And then as I'm finishing, you know, before I send it to my editor, I'm finishing this novel in March of 2020. And here comes this pandemic. And also Seymour is researching this young character in Idaho is researching climate change. And a lot of these predictions that when I'm starting to read them in 2015 are saying, you know, we're going to have mega fires, we're going to have much warmer summers, but they're predicting those in 2030. And here they come, they're coming in 2019, 2020. So, and then finally AI, I'm reading about Sybil. I invent this almost character that occupies this vault with Constance named Sybil, who's this ultra super complex AI. And, you know, all this fascinating stuff coming out about the possibilities for AI are also swirling around. So the urgency of some of the preoccupations of the novel as 2020 and 2021 start looming started to become a lot more prevalent in my mind, for sure.
Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Anthony Doerr speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Cloud Cuckoo Land. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.